and we have a packet to give them as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Hi, this is Sam. Steve, I have a question to Rich about the advisory committee. Rich, do we have any applicants from the County of Santa Cruz currently?
I can't off the top of my head, I do not recall, but typically it's not an application process. Somebody would come to you because you're on the board and say, I'm willing to serve, or you would go out to somebody you're aware of in the community and say, are you willing to serve? But occasionally people have said, I'm interested in serving on your advisory committee, and then I've directed them to the appropriate board member for consideration. So you'll be bringing them forward. The board will fully and formally adopt their participation on the committee.
And do we have outreach or ongoing kind of notices on the website soliciting for advisory committee members?
We do not. I know Anne was working on developing something along those lines. If you're not aware of folks that would be good in participating on the committee, then we could certainly do an outreach program to let folks know.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'll see if I can find somebody and let you know. But if you hear somebody from the County of Santa Cruz that's interested, I'd say please let me know. Okay.
And then Director Askew just sent a message to us. So is that on our website now, Ann? Outreach for?
No, you were going to check with the board first to see if they were good with that.
I just posted a link that shows who the sitting committee members are and which director has appointed those members.
So I'd leave it up to the board. If you'd like me to do some outreach, that's certainly something Great. We're willing to do.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. At this point in time, any member of the board that has anything they'd like to share, now's your chance. We had a great Central Coast Community Energy meeting today, and I'm proud to report, as I think some of us saw, that there'll be additional funds for grant money incentives to purchase EVs. So that's real good. And there were great things said about working with the Air District. So very good. Rich, you want to proceed with your report?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me be one of the last to say Happy New Year to you, since we're in the second month here. And welcoming all the new and returning board members. I just want to let you know we've developed a new onboarding, electronic onboarding manual for new board members and existing board members. So if you're, you should have been sent that, Anne should have sent that to you. But it's a great resource for current board members as well as new board members. And I just want to let you know, I've spoken to all the new board members and had an orientation session as I typically do. So we should be up and running in that regard. With respect to engineering, because of the lifting the state's regional stay at home order, we now have inspectors that have resumed in-person physically distance inspections. So that's sort of normalizing a little. Hopefully we'll get in line to get our vaccinations soon as well. And then you've heard me talk about the state's criteria and toxics regulation. That's the California Air Resources Board. They have a 15-day change review period for this regulation on February 11th. Staff attended. We were instrumental in getting many of the changes to the regulation, but this this regulation will hit smaller sources beginning in 2025, and it's going to require additional reporting where facilities used to just have to report criteria pollutants, the six criteria pollutants. Now they're going to be required to start reporting all their toxic emissions as well, and that can be significantly burdensome to the smaller businesses. So we were sort of in their corners arguing that they didn't, the state did not need as much detail as they were looking for, especially because there's not a lot of data on some of the toxics information that they're requesting. Also on our Acela implementation that's moving forward, we'll be loading our second data conversion set this week from our previous database TrackIt. And we've scheduled daily user training for the first week in March. So that's really good news. We're really excited about getting that database up and running. In planning and air monitoring, our wood stove changeout program continues. That program incentivizes the replacement of non-certified EPA wood stoves with cleaner burning alternatives such as natural gas and propane. And that's open to all residents throughout our three-county jurisdiction. The program offers $1,500 to replace a non-certified wood stove or open hearth fireplace with a new natural gas propane pellet, electric heater, or ductless mini split heat pump, or $1,000 for an EPA-certified wood-burning stove or fireplace insert. Low-income applicants can receive an additional $2,000 incentive. And this is available, as I said, through to all homeowners throughout the district. So far, we've had 63 applications, and six of those are low income. So we've obligated about 100 grand, and we've got about 63,000 or 40% of the funds remaining. So we'll take some money there out of that as for administrative costs as well. But that's moving along. There is no money scheduled from the state for next year. So we're zeroed out on that program. So if we want to run a wood stove changeout program next year, it's going to come out of our pocket. So as we develop the budget, which we are currently doing, we'll put some placeholders in there for further consideration of the board. Applications are now being accepted for the diesel engine and equipment replacement program. DER program is what we call it, or DEER, which that uses state grant funds for replacing higher pollutant diesel equipment with cleaner burning models. And so the application period ends on March 19th. We just recently installed a new air monitoring station at the San Juan Bautista Elementary School to measure PM10, and that's been required due to federal regulations. We exceeded 80% of the National Ambient Air Quality Standard in October 2019 at our Hollister Air Monitoring Station. So EPA came in and said, we have to install another monitoring station. So we've done that. And then as Director McShane mentioned, we've run out of funds for our EV incentive program. It was a considerable consternation with folks over at Monterey Community Power, or 3CE. The people said, you know, we ran out of funding or we're no longer having a program. Nothing could be further from the truth. This was a really successful program this year. We had more money than in previous years. Typically, we have $400,000. This year, we had $500,000. And typically, we take all year to spend that down. And this year, we did it in under 6 months' time. I think there was a mad dash at the beginning of the year. People thought that the program was going to end or something. And so we processed a lot of applications. So we've incentivized the purchase or lease of 244 EVs. Six of those were for low-income residents. As I said, we spent close to the $500,000 in 6 months' time. And this was a really successful program, so much so that we're going to be looking into coughing up additional monies. We'll look at our budget again as we develop it for this upcoming year, because this is wildly successful. And I know a number of board members took advantage of this. So this is, it's a great program. We also see that the Central Coast Community Energy is also going to have a similar program. We've been talking to them. What we don't want to do is get into a situation where we did the previous year, where we had competing, confusing programs, and the programs were very different. We tried to lump them together, and it just added to confusion among the public. And as a result, we actually didn't spend down all our money. And I think that Community Power was only able to incentivize some 20 vehicles or something. So we think that I was talking to Rob Shaw at Community Power, and we think that separate but equal programs might be the way to go. We've lent them all the information we have on the program that we've developed. We think it's a really excellent program, and it really has taken a while to get to where we're at, because we've gone through many trials and tribulations, and we've got the program fully automated now on a database system, and we can process applications really efficiently and effectively. So we've given all that information to Community Power. And so our hope is that perhaps together we can remind the public that not only can they get money from us, but they can also get it from Community Power, and they can do the same. And then we may build a lower incentives. For instance, we can say that maybe next year, instead of $2,000, we'll offer $1,500, but Community Power through their program will also kick in an additional $1,500. So it's a gain of some, $1,000 between the two programs, and we'll definitely do coordinated outreach with those two programs in mind. And hopefully folks that live in our three county region can really take advantage of that. This will not be available, this type of program from the Air District will not be available in the other two counties that's currently under 3CE's jurisdiction. So Santa Barbara and Ventura County, as far as I know, does not have money for an electric vehicle rebate program. So they may be able to offer their rebate 3CE to residents there, but it will not include any contribution from the Air District. Okay, and then just on outreach, I just wanted to still let you know, you've probably seen we have a number of spots running on KSBW, on the radio station KPIG and KAZU, and we've got a number of commercials or outreach segments running on Entravision, which is Spanish stations. And we're also looking into Nextdoor as another way to inform and educate the public online. So we're continuing our efforts outreach in this new year. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thanks, Rich. Any questions for our air pollution control officer?
Yep.
Director Askew.
Thank you. I just had a question about the electric vehicle rebate program. And I know that some of that is grant funded and is specific to vehicles, but what is there any opportunity to include electric bikes in that if we're using funding that isn't already tied specifically to a vehicle?
You know, that's a really good question. We can look into that. Typically, what we like to see is that we count on the electric bike to reducing emissions. So if you were to switch out a regular bicycle with an electric bike, there's no real emissions gain or benefit there. If you're gonna leave your gas or diesel truck or car at home and take an electric bike, then we could try to quantify it. Making people do that is fairly difficult. Once people register their vehicles, they usually drive those, but we don't require in the case of electric vehicles that you destroy another vehicle. So we can look into that. It's just that the cost effectiveness of providing for electric bikes is not really up there as with electric vehicles. So there's been a lot of talk, we've had people want scooters, electric scooters. A number of cities have run those programs. I don't know if any of the cities want to talk about that, but some of them have been complete disasters. But that's something we can talk about. We also do offer money for electric motorcycles. I think it's a couple hundred dollars as opposed to, $15,000 or $2,000 for an electric vehicle. So that's something we could add to our program. We could take a look at that for this next program. And we're certainly looking, as I said, we're also going to look at some maybe public-private efforts to increase the grant award that we have. Maybe we can team up with some of the manufacturers or dealers in the area to have higher incentives as we move forward. And we certainly could do that also with a number of the bike dealers and distributors. So we can take a look at bikes for this upcoming year.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. I just, you know, speaking for myself, my family is not financially in a position to be investing in a new vehicle anytime soon. However, I did happen to borrow an electric bike from someone, and I no longer ride my car around town for any errands. I've now started exclusively using the electric bike for that purpose. But again, wasn't in the market to purchase a $2,000 bike had it not suddenly shown up on my front porch. So I think there would be a whole audience of people that we would be able to reach that would never be able to access or utilize the EV incentive. So I would encourage us to take a look at that.
Yes, we will. And we also have to do a better job on low income. And with respect to the price of cars, some of these cars are coming down well below $10,000. There's a slug of vehicles coming back from return lease after 3 years. And some of these EVs, the Leaf, as well as others, you can get some of these. I've heard of people picking up a used Leaf for $5,000, which certainly would be something that a low-income person could use and enjoy, especially because of the maintenance is so low on those things, so low cost. So we're going to be looking into that, and we certainly can add a bike component. We've had a love-hate relationship with bicycles. We could go into that, but it's just the emission reductions aren't always there, but certainly if it helps with the mobility and that sort of thing, we'll take a look at it and come back with a recommendation.
Thank you. Any other questions for Rich there?
Yeah, I do. Colin Kuznicki, thank you. Just a real quick question. You mentioned the Hollister station had exceeded the limits. Is there any kind of precedence for that? Can you maybe expand on, you know, how the significance of, could it be a fluke? Just so I can report back on that.
Well, my understanding, and I've got my air monitoring guys, or I saw there, now they've disappeared. Oh, there's Dave. I think that we had an exceedance. It was probably due to wildfires, right? And we don't get an excuse for that. Or did we get an exceptional event excuse for that? But we had one day, I know, that we just had some really weird meteorology. And it so happens that the monitor picked up a lot of particulate matter, and that's 10 PM 10. And when that happens, it sort of triggers a requirement under Federal Clean Air Act that we have to start looking at additional monitoring sites to make sure that's not going to be a problem going forward. So I don't know, David, if you want to fill in any of the gaps I left, that would be appreciated.
Yeah. So we've seen an interesting phenomena over the last couple of years that we've noticed in the fall, where we've had some essentially just wind coming from the southeast deserts area. And we've seen increases in PM10 regionally. So not just one particular air monitoring station will show it. We'll see it all over the state. And it's usually when that one particular phenomenon is occurring. So I believe that was the case with this one exceedance. It was somewhat of an anomaly. Unfortunately, the EPA requires that if it exceeds 80% of the standard, we've got to add another air monitoring station. So that's what we had to do. So Bill Chevalier, our supervisor's on the line. Bill, do you have anything further to say on that?
Yes. So the condition that caused that exceedance of 80% of the NACs, we do see that we've been seeing it for the past couple of years, although that was the only one where we've seen it exceed 80%. And I'll just reiterate what everyone else said. As soon as we exceed 80%, it's mandatory that we add another station. There's no choice involved in this.
Okay. I appreciate it.
All right. Anybody else? Okay. Members of the public, just looking real quick here. Okay, I don't see anything. Great. Well, that takes us to our consent agenda. We have 7 items. Let's start with any member of the board wishing to pull a consent item from the agenda. Okay, seeing none, we'll just quickly go to the public. Don't see any hands raised. Ann, nothing. Okay. So we'll come back to the board. We're looking for a motion on the consent agenda.
Ms. Phillips, move consent.
OK, Okay. Need a second?
Is Sam second?
Okay. Second by Story. It's been moved and seconded. Anne, want to call the roll?
Yes, when I call your name, please answer yes or no. Chris Lopez? Is he still with us? Okay. Jack Dillis?
Yes.
John Phillips?
Aye.
Colin, I'm sorry, because I'm reading your names. Director Kosmicki?
Yes. Aye.
Director LaBar?
Aye.
Director Coonerty?
Aye.
Director Story?
Yes.
Director McShane?
Yes.
Director Askew?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Aye.
It passes.
Great, thank you. We'll proceed to the regular agenda. And the first item is an action item, and it is an item I commented on earlier. Coming from the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee, our report and our recommendation is to appoint Sam Story to the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee. Rich, I don't know if you want to add anything.
No, I just think it's Sam will be a great resource for the Budget Personnel Nominating. He's got really good fiscal chops, and of course he's got 7 years of experience previously with the board, and numerous years also on the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee. So I think it's a good selection.
Great, thanks. Any member of the board, any questions? Great. Going to the public.
Steve, before you call the vote, if I may.
Yeah, please.
Well, first of all, I'm happy to serve on the committee, and I'm honored. Thank you for those kind remarks, Richard. But being the new kid on the block, I just wanted to let everybody know if there was a standing board member who wanted to be on the committee, please feel free to let me know. Otherwise, I'm happy to serve. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, so we're looking for a motion and a second.
I'll move. LaBar, motion to approve.
I'll second that then.
Okay, so we got a motion and a second. Anne, will you call the roll?
Make that note. When I call your name, please answer in the affirmative or negative. Director Lopez? Director Lopez? Okay. Director Dillis?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Aye.
Director Kosmicki?
Aye.
Director LaBar?
Aye.
Director Coonerty?
Aye.
Director Story?
Aye.
Director McShane?
Yes.
Director Askew?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Great. Well, the next item is certainly an exciting topic that I know the Air Pollution Control Officer and I have talked about a few times. And as I know, we have a resident of Marina and a supervisor that's probably already gotten calls on this topic. I'm looking forward to this and appreciate you bringing it up. So Rich, you want to tee up the next item?
Yeah, I'll tee it up, and Amy Klima will give you a quick presentation just with some slides and maps and information. But this is a tough one for us. It's because the first thing that the public wants to do whenever there's an odor is they want to pick up and they find us in the phone book and they make a complaint. And that's because the air quality is bad due to odors. However, we do not really regulate odors. We don't have the regulatory authority outside of maybe a nuisance law or two. But in this case, many of the sources that are contributing to the odor may in fact be exempt from our nuisance provisions. So we're pretty much hamstrung, but in the interest of the public good and being good government, we have been taking complaints in. We have been writing them down, and then we've put together a listserv. And so when we do receive complaints, we let the appropriate agencies know that we've received the complaints when and where in as much detail as we can according to our complaint form. But we're getting sucked into something that is starting to get legs of its own. There's been talk about an odor attribution study occurring in the near future that either one or more of the sources would contribute to. And they're probably looking for a contribution from the Air District too. And so before we get, we're probably up to our waist right now. We were at our knees for a while, and we did attend a pretty big public meeting last month where there were over 75 members present on Zoom. You know, we did talk about our responsibilities and so forth. So at the end of the day, the city suggested that everybody continue to let the Air District know if they had complaints. And so I wanted to give you a heads up as far as what's going on about our responsibilities, and wanted to gauge the board's input and get your direction on how much you want us to get involved. These things can really take a lot of wind out of you, and the resource allocation to this type of problem can be just bottomless. And that's because, as Amy will talk about, we have not just one source, we have several sources of air pollution. And I think it's not that any one of those is responsible. I think that most of them are responsible at any given time, but probably not all at once. And they probably take turns. And I don't think anybody has a, can say it's absolutely not them, but I'll let Amy go through her presentation, then we can have a better discussion in the end. So without further ado, Amy.
Okay, so let me just share my screen here. So my name is Amy Climo. I'm the engineering and compliance manager here at MBARD. And so I'm just gonna give you a brief regulatory setting, what regulations apply to odors, and what our experience has been with receiving complaints from residents in the city of Marina, and what our activities are, and then open it up for discussion. So we have a rule 402 that's for nuisance. And so it just applies to any air contaminant that could cause a public nuisance. And this is different from what David had talked before about PM10 and a monitor. That's a very specific pollutant that you put a monitor out and you measure it. Odors are not like that. It's a combination of lots of different chemicals. So there's no measuring device to put out to measure odors. So odors are a little bit trickier to handle than a known pollutant. And so this part of the health and safety code that allows us to enforce for nuisance has several exceptions for odors. And one of those exceptions is odors emanating from agricultural operations necessary for the growing of crops or raising of fowl or animals. So we cannot issue any kind of odor nuisance for agricultural operations. We cannot issue an odor nuisance for odors from compost operations. And we can't issue an odor nuisance for composting that is related to agricultural operations. And so I'll discuss later how this plays into what's going on with those complaints from Marina. And if we do get an odor complaint related to composting, that middle option, we are required to forward within 24 hours or the next business day to the enforcement agency. And for composting, it's a little bit different in each county. So in Monterey County, the enforcement agency is the Monterey County Environmental Health Department. They're in charge of compost odors. In Santa Cruz and San Benito counties, CalRecycle, which is a state agency, is the enforcement agency for composting. So back in 2017, we began receiving complaints from residents in the city of Marina. And those were primarily from people in the northern area of the city. And as you can see, the numbers have slightly gone down over time. We had the most complaints in 2017. And this is possibly because one of the operations that I will talk about in just a moment stopped operating in 2019. So things kind of had changed a little bit. So anytime we get an odor complaint, you kind of have to figure out the context of what's going on around it. So this is a figure showing the two red circles are the main areas where we are getting complaints, those neighborhoods in the northern part of the city of Marina. And so when you zoom out to this level, you can see there are surrounded by some agricultural operations. They are somewhat near the coast. Maybe if there's some kelp that's washed up and it's stinky on the, you know, ocean, you're getting an onshore breeze, maybe they might smell that. And then there's also the Monterey Regional Environmental Park. And within that boundary, there is a wastewater treatment plant, a compost operation, and a landfill. And those types of sources can emit odors. And so we also have several other kinds of equipment like emergency engines or gas stations that are also possibly permitted in the city. But those are a little easier to rule out because the odors are described as rancid or composty or woody. And so if you go around these neighborhoods, it's not those kinds of sources. It's more likely possibly a source in the Monterey Regional Environmental Park or those agricultural fields in between. And so a state law was passed in 2016, which requires the diversion of organic waste from landfills. And so this means that food waste has to begin to be diverted from landfills. And so a pilot biodigester project was placed within the Monterey Regional Environmental Park to determine whether this anaerobic digestion process would be a useful way to divert that food waste. And so that operation shut down in 2019, but we believe there were times where that operation was potentially creating odors. And biodigesters are treated like compost operations where the Monterey County Environmental Health Department has the enforcement and regulatory authority over odors from that type of a source. So this is a challenging issue for the Air District because there are so many potential sources of odor in proximity to where the residences are experiencing and complaining about odors. And the processes for these operations may vary over space and time. And then there's different regulatory agencies who have jurisdiction over odor enforcement. And then meteorology is also plays a factor here. We primarily see complaints coming in October to May. And during that time of the year, there are occasions where we get a northeast, a wind from the north. And so let me see if I can go back. It's possible that the wind could be blowing down from the ag fields or the Monterey Regional Environmental Park and blowing some odors down to the city, the residents in those neighborhoods. And then there's also, it's actually for some of the board members that have been here for a while, we talk about inversion layers in San Lorenzo Valley from wood smoke. The same thing can actually occur here in Marina, where if there's cold air can be trapped, those odors can be trapped at ground level when there's an inversion that's in place. And so those odors may not disperse as they normally would if it were a windier day, which is often the case in Marina. And then finally, odors are very person dependent. Humans experience odor characteristics differently and the intensity differently. And so one person might be completely oblivious to the smell, but another person might be very sensitive to the smell. So what are our regular kind of activities that we do? So we conduct routine inspections for those facilities that are located in that Monterey Regional Environmental Park and for gas stations, engines, equipment that we permit. We also issue permits as needed. For example, if one of the facilities in that Monterey Regional Environmental Park gets a new piece of equipment that requires an air district permit, they would apply for a permit and pay permit fees. And so that would pay for our staff time. And we collect annual renewal fees from all of our permitted sources. And that revenue funds our compliance inspections and our engineering as well. And then our compliance division also responds to complaints. And so these odor complaints that we're receiving are handled by our inspectors. And we don't have a direct revenue source to respond to complaints. It just comes from our general fund. And with the city of the odors that when we receive them from residents in Marina, we have established a system, as Rich mentioned, where we send out an email and it goes to the other regulatory agencies and then also the sources. And so they can let us know what they might be, what their operations were that day or what they may be observing because they're on the ground there. And then also finally, as Rich mentioned, we participated in a public meeting on January 27th where our inspector, Bronwyn Nielsen, who is the main inspector who has been, who covers the area of Marina, did a short presentation. So with that, we are looking to you for direction on how to proceed.
Thank you, Amy. Well, I'm sure there's feedback on this, maybe some questions as well. Do you want to start, Director Askew?
Sure, I think Jack had his hand up first, so I'll defer, but definitely have some questions.
Be there. Okay, well, let's start there.
Okay, thank you. I'm just wondering what we have to do. Obviously, in other words, it sounds like we're taking the complaints and then we send our inspectors out and then we flip it over to the regulatory agencies that are responsible for enforcement. And so do we have to take the complaints? That's a question. And my other question is, do we have any concept of what the cost could be? I think I heard the word bottomless, but are we any... idea of how much staff resources that could take and or how much money it would cost. Bottomless sounds kind of big to me, or potentially big. So those are my two questions. Do we have to take the complaints? And what would it cost us if we continue to be involved?
I'll try to handle those. So we don't necessarily have to take the complaints, but we are a regulatory enforcement agency. So we would like to make the determination that, for instance, it's not a problem, another problem of the source that we do regulate. So we're gonna probably investigate that anyways. We do hand that off to the other agencies and let the sources know that we received the complaint. So you know, we could put as a disclaimer, and other air districts have done this too, if you have an odor complaint, do not, you know, leave us a complaint. Here are the regulatory authorities that can deal with that. That's one avenue. The bottomless that I've mentioned is I keep on telling staff, we don't have an income source for this. So, you know, we've been responding to complaints. We've been calling people back. So I bet we could spend up to $50,000 a year easily in staff time on this. If we were, you know, we had a number of staff participating in the public meeting. And then, of course, if people are going to want to tap us for a resource for contributions to an attribution study, then, you know, that's additional dollars. And it's just part of our responsibility is for air quality, and it's hard to separate out odor from that. But there is no odor in the Clean Air Act. There's no reference to odor. It's all pollutant-based. And so, we just don't have. We could invest in, you know, there's things called nasal rangers, believe it or not, that are an attempt to quantify odors, but they're still pretty subjective. So we could sink a lot of money into this, but at this time, you know, we're trying to work collaboratively with the other entities and cooperate, but we don't want to see a huge investment unless the board thinks that that's what you'd like to see. So $50,000 a year without having any kind of additional revenue to support that.
Okay, let's go.
Thank you. Yeah, Director Askew, you ready?
No, thank you. Yeah. So I just want to, you know, I'm a resident of Marina. I'm here representing the community of Marina. And I'm going to be like, appeal to everyone in this board that this really is a quality of life issue for people who live in Marina. The descriptions of these odors are rancid. It is not clear where they're coming from. That's why we need some sort of study to determine what the cause or where the source of these odors are. It's an issue that's experienced from East Garrison through different portions of the city. And while it may not be, as you know, Director Sedman explained, we may not ultimately be our direct responsibility. The community absolutely connects this issue with the Air District and the Air Board. And so I think the opportunity right now to provide the data that will allow us to deal with the problem, or at least understand exactly where the issue is, source of the issue is from, is an expectation that the community has for this board and this body. But the questions that I would have, is there somebody else who would be responsible if we were not to take any action? Where would the responsibility lie?
Well, you know, as Amy pointed out, typically the county has the regulatory authority as the local environmental agency for enforcement. So, but their problem is that if there is an odor, they expect odors to come out of these operations. So they go out and they inspect for best management practices. If they're not applying best management practices, then they will be cited. But if there are any and odors being emitted and they're doing everything they can, then I understand this, the county cannot cite them for that because there's nothing more they can do. And a lot of these operations are particularly nasty. Landfills do smell. Composting smells, especially this now raw food waste. That's something that the Cal Recycle with the diversion of the food waste didn't really consider. It is an air quality consideration and concern from a methane standpoint too. We're having a lot of VOCs being emitted from these types of operations. And we just came into compliance with our own zone standard and VOC is a precursor. So we're concerned about that. We're being sort of, here you deal with it. Most of these operations are taking place at landfills, but wastewater treatment plants too stink to high heaven. If you ever go to the biosolids area, it's a problem, but we typically have pretty good buffers around these types of facilities so that the public is not typically exposed. And usually they're required to keep their odors on their property. So, but we know that there's no way to erect a bubble or a fence. So, you know, we realize too that we're not going to say, don't bother us. We want to work with the public to the extent we can, but we're running out of tools in our tool bag. You know, if the board wanted me to carve out a budget for this, then I could work something up. Especially if we're looking at an odor study. We know from experience that an odor study up in the Bay Area, which is similar players and similar situation, they've already invested $500,000 into it and they really don't have an answer yet. And I have a feeling that it's gonna come down to, yeah, well, it's probably the landfill part of the time. It's probably the wastewater treatment because they actually landfill some of their biosolids. It's probably agriculture at times. It's probably, you know, it's going to be a number of those different sources. But the problem is people are really married to one idea that it's definitely coming from ag or it's definitely coming from the landfill or from the composting. And people will not, you know, they've got their opinions on that. So it's like Amy said too, odors, there's no such thing as an odor monitoring device that you can place out to detect things. The human nose is more sophisticated than any monitoring device ever established. And to sort of cap that off, it's a very subjective type of assessment too, because, you know, some people, for instance, coffee roasters, we get a lot of complaints about those guys, but then some people love the smell. Because they think it's, you know, the same with brewing beer and all that. There you go. But I will say coffee roasting is a lot more concentrated than the aroma from coffee. But anyways, so long story short, it's just sort of this quagmire, and I say bottomless because we really don't know where the bottom is. And we know that there are people that are experiencing quality of life issues, but we also know that we had a call the other day. Somebody said, yeah, I can smell it. And then so, well, yeah, but it comes and goes and I haven't smelled it for a long time. So, I mean, is that a quality of life? It was, you know, maybe an instantaneous thing and then it moved on. So, but, you know, people are being told now to call the air district with their complaints. So, you know, we can still, my recommendation to the board would be to continue remaining involved with all the parties, to continue our hotline and do our cursory investigations to make sure it's not a regulated source that is causing an odor. And then work with the sources. We can provide technical assistance, for instance, if there's going to be a study, we could sit on a panel to judge the RFP or go through the RFP process. But as far as kicking in money, we've had some budgetary constraints there, and to free up that money at this point, I would not recommend that we do that because I remain sort of skeptical that we really will find the source after spending a lot of money.
No, and that's fair. And I want to, you know, be really clear. Like right now, what's happening is that it's nobody's fault and everybody's pointing at someone else. And there's no single agency that's stepped up to say, we're going to be a part of the solution and we're going to help identify where the actual issue is so that we can be a part of solving the issue. And so I do see the community looking to the Air District to take some leadership, to step into a position where we're going to help identify what the challenge, where the source of this odor is coming from, or the sources of these odors are coming from, so that appropriate regulatory action could be taken if it's possible. And if not, we can be really clear with the community that the source of this odor is something that can't be regulated unless you go deal with it at the state level and ask for a different set of laws to be put into place. You know, the complaints that are listed here are small, but I will tell you that as a resident that reads next door, that's on Facebook, that's out walking and talking to neighbors in the community, the concern is significantly larger than what's represented in this report and with the phone calls that have come in. So I would just ask this body that to recognize, rather than pointing the finger back to another group, that if there is a place for us to step in and be a part of the solution and be a part of identifying how to move forward, I would ask that we do that.
Well, and we can, but I would just say we feel very confident that we've identified the sources. We know what the sources are. They were contained in Amy's report. And as I said earlier, I believe that it's probably all of the sources that are contributing at one time or another. So that gets, and that's where we look at, well, then who has the regulatory hook? And we definitely do not have it for agriculture. We're excluded from acting on that, and we can't go against state law on that. And the same goes for the composting, and the same for, you know, the landfill. The landfill is actually a complicated issue because we are regulating gases. They have combustion gases, methane that they're burning. That certainly can contribute to that burning odor. And then also there's been a huge emissions of H2S gas from the facility because of the construction boom that's been taking place and the disposal of drywall and related building products. So we've been addressing those issues with the landfill, and the landfill has been fairly responsive on dealing with those challenges. So we are addressing what might be part of the problem, but we don't have a handle specifically. There's no regulation for odor from landfills. We don't regulate that. So, and if they're doing their cover, the county goes and looks and says, okay, they're putting cover on it. So they're supposed to put a certain amount of dirt over the open landfill sections each day. If they don't do that, then they can receive a citation. That would contribute to odors. But we don't go out to inspect for that. And and we know the landfill leaks. We have under state contract, we're actually managing program to look at methane emissions from landfill. So, I mean, we're doing a lot. We're trying to shut that down. But, you know, as far as the odor police, there's just, we're trying to facilitate collaboration, cooperation, I think, which is what you were speaking to. But as far as us owning it, we haven't done that yet, because I wanted to make sure that the board understood the ramifications before we would embark in such an engagement, so.
Thank you, Rich. I knew Director Askew would have direct feedback on this one too. And it'll be interesting to see as we provide direction. So I have Director Phillips and then Director LaBarre. So Director Phillips.
Yeah, we've been dealing with this for 5 or 6 years, and we definitely don't want to own this. And the problem I see is about anything that can be contributing to this is something businesses that we really don't have the authority to regulate, and especially when it's odor, and that's not something that we're dealing with. So, and I know ag is in there. Ramco's put a bunch of fields in there between the industrial park and this. So it could be Ramco. It could be Keith Day's composting operation is huge. M1W is there. But those are all things that we can't regulate. It seems to me if someone's going to get in and do something about it, it's got to be environmental health that has a greater responsibility. Maybe environmental health working with Marina can do a study, but a study like this is going to just, as you mentioned, is going to be bottomless. And we've gone out there time and time again and investigated, and it's got us nowhere. So I would be opposed to us getting into this in the middle of this.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll just add to that. Thank you for pointing out Monterey One. You know, we actually have written violation notices of violation for odors coming from wastewater treatment plants, specifically in the Spreckles area. And that's because usually if they have an upset with their digestion or their bacteriological process goes anaerobic, then it will go septic and then emit odors. And it's really easy to say that's your problem. These guys produce biosolids, and we're not aware of any upsets in their ponds or anything like that. But if you've ever smelled spent biosolids, it's not a great thing. So we know those get landfilled, and some of these things are just, there's even discussion of additional development in that area. And I know LAFCO was involved in the last meeting as well because of the concerns of the public and what that may expose folks to. But yeah, we can try to continue to work with the regulatory authorities, including environmental health, on this. And I think we have a lot to offer with respect to our expertise on meteorology and that sort of thing. But, you know, you could also do a full-blown meteorological study at that area, because you can't just rely on general wind directions. We know there are microclimates and different wind patterns and that sort of thing. So, you know, that's another one of those things we could throw probably at least a couple $100,000 at trying to ascertain what the wind looks like at any given moment in the marine area. And I don't think that would be an exceptionally good use of money at this point.
No, thank you, Rich. I know we still have several items on the agenda and closed session, so I just want to be mindful. Let's go to Director LaBarre.
Thank you, Chair. So quickly, I think the process the agency should take is if they receive a phone call, they should refer those people to the correct agency to file their complaint. That should be the first step. And using a disclaimer on a website under the contact page would be very helpful. Secondly, it looks like this would, any kind of thing, what we're talking about, changes have to be made at the state level for agencies to have the authority. Odors is very difficult. Third, to initiate, to become part of any kind of study or to take any type of ownership in relationship to one city would also open the door, is then why can't any other city or county ask for the exact same thing? So all of a sudden, the exponential expansion of duties that aren't under the jurisdiction would be expanded. And then lastly, I do not believe we should enter in any study. I'm a full believer that you operate under your authorities and jurisdictions only, and then you spend your resources on what those authorities and your jurisdiction is. I can sympathize with the smell of odors. We do get that occasionally from our wastewater treatment plant, but that's kind of just like life. I mean, that's what happens. So I refer to the actual agencies that have the closest or any jurisdiction would be the first recommendation. And then those jurisdictions on their, when they go and look at the situation, if they think the air district should come out and do an inspection, that would be the proper role and mechanism. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Director Labar. I think just summarizing what Rich had recommended, you know, communication, the hotline, working with potential sources, and then ongoing cursory investigation. We could even go so far as to write a letter on behalf of the district to Environmental Health, you know, solidifying this commitment. I'm looking for anybody else that has a thought. That's what's recommended here before we take it out to the public and then come back.
Chair, this is Labar. I don't think writing a letter, and I think we should be very clear of where our limitations are to those other agencies. I would fear that if you express some amount of authority or that could be built upon or create a expectation that would be unnecessary. I think just being very clear of what we can do with the public and other agencies is always the best practice.
Excellent. Then, so with what Rich has recommended, unless I hear anything different, I think that was pretty clear. And I think the district's done a lot and will continue to work with this, certainly closely with the supervisor in that area.
If I can jump in one more time. So I think one of the things that I heard you saying, Rich, was that that you know where the source of the odors are, except we have complaints coming in and we aren't able to identify the source of the odor. So we're back to this beginning question of people are calling in to make a complaint. Nobody's clear about the source of that odor that's causing the complaint. And so the community is left with the air district saying, well, we'll call four different or five different places. We may or may not be able to identify what the source of the complaint is. We'll take your complaint and we'll just continue to track complaints. I mean, is that essentially what we're offering? Because if that's all that the air district is offering, I think we need to be really clear that that's all that the air district is willing to do, is to be a receptacle for complaints without being able to correctly or consistently identify the source of those complaints to pursue action if action is appropriate.
So I think that through the chair, I think that's a really good point, but you know, what I'm hearing is we don't want to own this, but we do want to have some engagement and be involved. Director Askew, with respect to identifying the odor, we have done investigations where we receive a complaint, we go out there and it's gone. And that may be because we can't smell it, they can't smell it any longer. So these are transitory at best. It's not a continuous, typically air quality, we're dealing with continuous emissions, not intermittent, not extraneous, moving around, but we have identified based on the complaints we've received that it can be attributed to one of those four odor sources. So, we typically, that's why when we do get a complaint, we let the source know, we let Environmental Health know that you may have a problem at the landfill or the composter or the wastewater treatment plant. Typically, I don't know if we, I'd have to ask Amy if we let Ag know that there's a
RAMCO's on the email.
So, that, there you go. So, I mean, but I think that, as I said earlier, I think all of those contribute to the problem. and that people are smelling more than just one source at any given time. So, I mean, a study could help perhaps identify who's mainly responsible, but I think it will show that maybe, here's my guess, it's 40% the landfill, 30 or 40% the composter, and then maybe the other sources are make up the balance. I'd say that's probably pretty close. I didn't even charge $500,000 for that. So, you know,
you're cheap.
And we have no ability to regulate the composter. And I have to say our friends at Environmental Health really don't have anything. So I could look into legislation too. This has been a bane to all air districts, this whole increase in compost, because not only does it cause more odors, but it's also causing more VOC emissions, which is what they're trying to reduce in the landfill, but they're creating additional ones in the composter. So it doesn't even make sense to me. So anyways, I think, why don't I report? I'll put a standing item on this, and we'll be talking to the county and other folks and the city and see where they're gonna head. And I could also talk to you, Director, ask you about some additional things, but we'll proceed cautiously forward. What I heard loud and clear is we're not gonna own it until you guys wanna buy it.
Thank you, Rich. If it's okay, let's go to the public on this. Just looking for anything else. I don't see. Anne, did you receive anything on this? Okay. Not an action item. So appreciate the report, the discussion, and I think Rich has direction there. So why don't we go ahead and move on to our next item, which is item 19. And that's our presentation from Amy there on our calendar year 2021 engineering and compliance activities, 2020, sorry. Amy?
Hi, okay, I'll go quickly. So in February each year, we just kind of provide an update on our annual activities in engineering and compliance. So of course, you know, COVID-19 impacted some of our work. In March 2020, we adjusted to remote work. We created a remote inspection protocol so that our inspectors could continue to try to get some inspections done remotely. And this involved communicating with sources, and they would provide us a photograph of an hour meter reading, let's say from an emergency engine. And then in June, as things started to loosen up maybe just a little bit, we created additional procedures for doing in-person inspections and trying to focus on inspections where you could remain outside and physically distanced with your mask and gloves to do in-person inspections. So I'm just going to go over a brief introduction to engineering compliance. This will probably help, especially for some of the new directors. And then I'll go through the activity data. So on the engineering side is kind of where if someone wants to install a piece of equipment, where it starts. And so the engineers will get a permit application and they will review that application and make sure that that equipment can meet all of the federal, state, and local regulations. And then they'll issue a permit with operating conditions. It might say you're only allowed to operate this emergency engine for 50 hours a year for testing and maintenance, because otherwise that engine should not be operating. It should only be operating if the power is out. But just to make sure the engine stays maintained, you're allowed to operate it for 50 hours during the year to make sure it would turn on when needed. The engineers also develop rules and regulations as they're needed. And then they also do annual emission inventory reporting, which Rich mentioned earlier is gonna kind of slightly change with the adoption of the state regulation. So last year in engineering, we received 349 applications. We had 110 startup inspections. So the engineers will go out and check equipment before they issue a permit to make sure it meets what was included in the application. And so when you get a permit, it's a two-step process. So the first thing you get is called an authority to construct. So that says, I've reviewed your application. The equipment you're telling me you're going to install can meet all of our regulations. So here's your authority, go install that equipment. And then once they've got that equipment installed, then they can get their permit to operate. We also issue registrations for agricultural engines. We had only one of those last year. We issued one Title V renewal last year, and a Title V permit is a federal level permit that addresses federal operating conditions. And we have 16 facilities in the three counties that have those type of permits. And then we also issued one emission reduction credit. And that is if a facility shuts down, they can bank their emissions that they've been emitting in something called as called an emission reduction credit. And so they can keep that if they want to use it later to install a new piece of equipment if they needed those credits, or they could sell those credits to another source. So just an overview, we have about 3,100 total permits in the three counties. And the primary permit type that we have is emergency engines. We have over 1,100 permitted emergency engines. We have 225 retail gas stations, 300 paint spray facilities, so that includes like auto body shops, 208 boilers, and 147 prime engines. And so the big thing that came in last year as a permit application is a Costco station in Seaside. So I think it's actually later this month that station should be opening up.
TV for your Zoom room.
So. Okay.
Oh, now look at this from
clients. Once a permit is issued,
it's message for this
into compliance. And so our inspectors go out and make sure that those
Robert, is that his
issued the permit meets the conditions on the permit. If they find that the facility is not maintaining records or they are not operating their equipment as they're supposed to, they may be issued a violation. We also have authority to regulate for the federal asbestos regulation. It's called a National Emission Standard for Hazardous Air Pollutants. So we receive notifications for projects that will be abating asbestos and doing demolition. And then we also respond to complaints from the compliance team. So in compliance, we did over 1,400 inspections. And we issued 95 notices to comply. And a notice to comply is more of an administrative kind of violation. It's not gonna be associated with penalties. It's for example, if you're not keeping your records or your logs the way that you are, we will give you a notice to comply as a reminder and put it on a timeline to say you need to start doing this. And then a notice of violation is where you would actually end up getting assessed penalties. And so we had 39 of those last year. We received 240 asbestos notifications. We did 213 asbestos inspections. We received 243 total complaints. We had 21 breakdowns. And that's one of those Title V sources that I mentioned. If they have some type of an equipment upset, they need to call us right away to tell us that something is not working, and so they can get some protection to get back into compliance and some type of an unexpected event. And then we had two variance orders. So sometimes UC Santa Cruz had to put their solar panels online, but in order to do that, they had to basically turn the electricity off to hook up the solar. And so they had to run their emergency engines to keep some minimum basic electricity going in some of the buildings. And so we had to issue them a variance to allow them to operate those emergency engines outside of what their permit would allow them to do. So they were able to do that under a variance. And so to go along with our odor complaints that we were talking about earlier, odors are our number one type of complaint that we received last year. We also often receive smoke complaints. That's usually either smoke from a neighbor's chimney or a backyard smoke from a burn in someone's backyard. We've gotten 27 dust complaints, 9 asbestos complaints. 9 other, that's just anything that doesn't meet these other categories, and then 7 about gas stations. So this is just the trend lines since 2013. And you can kind of see the very top dot, blue dotted line. We've slightly increased over time, but we have on average about 3,000 active permits. The blue dashed line is the total number of compliance inspections. And you can see it's kind of starting to level out a little bit. We've had some staff turnover. We have currently one less inspector on our team since December 2019. So our numbers were down last year for that reason. And because of COVID, we had a little freeze in inspections. And then the bottom three lines are related to permit applications, permits issued, and complaints. And those three are pretty stable. You can see we have a stable workload over the past 7 years. And we did also operate last year, one of our engineers left in May. So we are currently operating with only 3 engineers. So with the same level of work. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay. All right. Well, now's everybody's chance. I see Jack's on there and just looking okay. The floor is yours, Jack. Muted there.
Yeah, sorry about that. I heard about emission reduction credits. So I'm just a little curious about that. Is that something that, and you said it happens when somebody goes out of business, for instance, is that something that they purchased and they have some value to that we feel like we have to let them do that? Basically, why do we allow them to do that? And kind of what's the philosophy behind allowing them to sell an emission reduction credit? That's my first question.
Sure. So it's we don't advertise emission reduction credits. I would say a lot of times a facility will shut down and they don't put emission reduction credits in the bank just because they don't know that they can. But those are important. If it comes to certain sized facilities, I hate to bring this up, but this came up with wineries. If a winery wants to expand and their emissions as part of that expansion would go over a threshold that we have in our rules, they might need offsets. And they can go to this emission reduction credit bank and they can buy offsets from another facility that's shut down and banked those credits and use that to expand their facility. And it's, I think that maybe the theory behind it is that there's some level of emissions in the air that while that facility is shut down, that our air basin is capable of handling those VOCs. And so they're held in this bank so that if another facility needs to expand and buy those credits, they can emit that VOC that was removed when that facility went away, but there's still space in the air basin for that VOC to be emitted. And we are in a team, I don't know, Dave, if they've CARB's made the final designation, but we are going to attainment for ozone, which is what VOC contributes to. So I think that's partially the theory behind why it was established in the state health and safety code to allow air districts to do that.
Okay. Well, I know the state sells credits obviously for environmental purposes, and they're raising money to do good with it, right? Whatever that might be. And it sort of sounds like if you thought good was helping perhaps the wine industry or some other industry for good reasons, you know, economically or because wine's a wonderful thing, which it is. And I haven't stepped into this whole subject. I recall that it's out there somewhere as a discussion. Anyway, and so basically we're trying to let what's already there kind of continue, even if it's not the same business, perhaps the business that takes over for that business or a similar business. Is that kind of the?
Yeah, I don't know, Rich, if you know the theory. I mean, we've had this rule in our book for decades. I'm not sure exactly why emission reduction credits were established in the first place, the history of it.
It's to achieve parity within the air district. And actually, if you trade outside the air district, you can do it at a lesser rate. So for instance, if somebody wanted to buy an air district credits here and use them in San Joaquin, they would get about half the credit for full price. So that way it actually reduces it among, but they think there's a carrying capacity within an air district. So you're emitting that and you're already achieving all the clean air goals and regulations. So that's something the state set up. We keep our hands out of it. We don't try to barter or
we have no involvement in the money side. We just, yeah. We're just the bank of the credits and then the parties do the money part. We don't get involved in that at all.
So it's not helping our budget.
It's not helping our budget. In fact, it costs us money to operate.
Okay, thank you. My other question is about, there's a chart in the staff report that shows multi-year activity trends. And I noticed in the earlier years, 13 through, at least 13 and 14, it shows that permits issued exceeded permit applications. Is that just a timing issue, or are there times where we'd issue more than one permit for the same application?
Yeah, that's timing. So especially because there's that middle step I mentioned about an authority to construct. So you might turn in your permit application. We have 6 months to issue that authority to construct. And then you get 2 years to have that authority to construct. And so the timing is kind of all off on those.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Looking for anybody else, don't see any hands. Let's go to the public. And do you see anything? Okay, neither. Okay, good. All right, well, this is a report. So we'll move on to our last presentation. And there's David, great.
Thanks, Chairman McShane, members of the board. Mine's Dave Frisbee. I'm the Planning and Air Monitoring Manager at the district. And just wanted to provide you with an update of the and review of the air monitoring from 2020. Let's see if I can get this going here. Can you see that okay? All right. So just a quick overview of what we measure. We're measuring ozone as one of our pollutants. Ozone is derived from reaction between nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds in the presence of sunlight. Nitrogen oxides has sources such as combustion, your ICE internal combustion engines, boilers, power generation. VOCs come from your landfills, composting operations, which we discussed already, wineries. We also get some from vegetation and other sources as well. So ozone is actually a derived pollutant from the reaction. So it's we don't measure nitrogen oxides or VOCs directly. We measure ozone, which is an irritant to the lungs. We also measure for PM10 and PM2.5, which is particulate matter. It's a size of particulate, not we're not looking at a specific compound or mineral or anything in particular. It's all just about size. So we measure for PM10, which is particulate matter under 10 micrometers in size, and PM2.5, which is under 2.5 micrometers in size, which usually we see smoke is representative of PM2.5, and larger particles and dust is what we'll see in PM10. The district operates 6 air monitoring stations permanently throughout the district, throughout the air basin, rather. We've got all 6 of them measure PM2.5. We measure ozone in Santa Cruz, Salinas, Carmel Valley, Hollister, and King City. And in Hollister and King City, we measure for PM10. In the San Lorenzo Valley of Santa Cruz County, we measure PM2.5. We add 3 seasonal monitors between November and April of every year. That's to measure wintertime smoke from wood-burning stoves and fireplaces. which we wouldn't really see in the summertime, of course. And then the Pinnacles National Park, the National Park Service operates a ozone monitoring station to measure for visibility requirements they have from the federal government. Our air monitoring stations are modular buildings that house the monitoring equipment. We've got sample ports that are outside of the building. The buildings are maintained at a certain range of temperature to meet the certain requirements that we have. All the siting is done as approved by the EPA and the Air Resources Board. We also have some meteorological instruments on site as well. On the inside, we've got instruments are set up on racks. The samples are collected from outside the ambient air, which are drawn in, and then we've got a series of processes we run through to pretty much clean the sample and remove the moisture before they're measured. So we have standards that we have to meet. Both the federal government and California established standards for ozone PM2.5 and PM10. California is typically more stringent than the federal government standards. There's averaging times that they're averaged over, sort of not instantaneous measurements or readings. For ozone, we've got a 1 hour and 8 hour standard, and for PM2.5 and 10, we've got 24 hour averaging for the standards. As you can see here, for the national standard, we've got 150 micrograms per cubic meter, and California has a third of the standard. So it's much stricter in California. So for last year, this is the hourly peak ozone. This state standard is represented by this dashed line here. And you can see for all three counties, we've measured within the standard. And so we're all good with hourly peak ozone for the year. For the 8 hour ozone average for Santa Cruz County, Monterey County air monitoring stations, we've operated within the standards. In San Benito County, we exceeded on three different days in August and September. So we exceeded that standard at both the Pinnacles and in Hollister. That was likely due to the warm and dry and sunny conditions that you get when you get ozone generation, as well as probably the influence from the wildfires that were burning in the region. We had four wildfires locally burning all about the same time. We had the River, Carmel, the Dolan, and the CZU lightning complex fires, as well as up in Santa Clara County, the SCU lightning complex fires. So we're really getting hit pretty hard by wildfires at that time in the fall. For PM2.5 concentrations, you can see the first half of the year, we were good when I reported that back in August. Everything was within the federal standard for 35 micrograms per cubic meter. And with the influence of the wildfires, we saw really high concentrations throughout the district at all of our stations in August, September, and in October. And also in the San Lorenzo Valley as well, the seasonal monitors, you can see they were not operating after May. And then our one SLV monitor was still measuring, and it actually exceeded even the federal standard, which is right here at 150 micrograms per cubic meter. And that was all due to the influence from the wildfires. To increase the information we provide to the public during wildfire occurrences, we set out additional air monitoring stations. We especially targeted this past year the Salinas Valley with Gonzales, Soledad, and Greenfield. We set one up here at our district office in Big Sur and again in Watsonville. And it helps us just distribute more out there and get better information to the public. So we were seeing with those air monitoring stations, similar impact with, you know, from the wildfires in September and October. PM10, which does have a PM2.5 component, was also influenced. And you can see here the state standards of 50 micrograms per cubic meter. And the federal standard is 150. So we were exceeding the federal standard for PM10 in August. And then we were also seeing in August, September, October influence from the wildfires. You can see as it extended into November and December, we were still seeing exceedances of the state standard for PM10. That was likely due to dust impacts on the monitoring stations. This is very common. We do see in the dry season impacts exceeding the state standard. So our attainment status for all the federal standards, we are in attainment of those standards, have been for some time. The state designations right now, currently we're non-attainment transitional. Amy alluded to this earlier, the Air Resources Board is looking at designating us as attainment for ozone. We've, for the years 2017 to 2019, we did not exceed the, we actually did exceed one day in 2018, but that was excused due to an impact from a wildfire. So we are going to be for the first time in our history an attainment for ozone for the state standard, which is a big accomplishment. We'll see about this past year if the influences we have from the wildfires are going to be excused. So we have submitted a paperwork to request that exceptional event from the wildfires. We're still in non-attainment for PM10, for the state standard. And that's just something that we see every year due to mostly from agricultural dust in the Salinas Valley at our King City station. And for the rest of the pollutants, we're in attainment or unclassified. So with that, be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, David. I'm just looking right now, hang on here. Any questions from directors? Very helpful and informative. Let me go to the public real quick. Let's see, Ann, do you, I don't see anything.
I don't see anything, I haven't received anything.
Great, okay. Thank you very much, David. This is a presentation only, and it brings to closure our business for the meeting. We do have a closed session today. And let's see, Les, do you anticipate there'll be reportable action?
Thank you, Chair. I do not anticipate any reportable action. So, Ann, you could have the minutes reflect that the board adjourned out of closed session. Directors, I sent a separate invitation via Zoom for the closed session. Hopefully you've received it. And as soon as you log off of this meeting, please log into that invitation.
Great. So we'll have folks call or
all right.
Zoom it. All right. We'll go ahead and adjourn. Thanks so much. Thank you.